rich, but it did give him some working capital for the expenses involved in preparing the journals for publication, with enough left over to let him become a player in the St. Louis-based fur trade. For himself, for Clark, except for his pay scale, for the men, it was all Lewis could have hoped for or expected. There were more expenses to be paid, including the cost of getting Big White back to the Mandans. Obviously, when the final settlement was made, the expedition was going to turn out costing a lot more than had been anticipated. Jefferson never complained. He was no more likely to haggle over the costs of the expedition than over his own building operations at Monticello, because he regarded the expenditure as an investment in the future of the country. In July 1808, the president went on record on the matter. He wrote the French naturalist Bernard Lacépède, "I can assure you that the addition to our knowledge in every department resulting from this tour of Messrs. Lewis and Clark has entirely fulfilled my expectations in setting it on foot, and that the world will find that those travelers have well earned its favor." There was another compensation for the captains in the form of their new appointments. On February 28, 1807, Jefferson nominated Lewis to be governor of the territory of Louisiana. The Senate approved the nomination, and on March 2nd, Lewis resigned his commission in the Army. At the same time, Jefferson wanted to nominate Clark for promotion to lieutenant colonel, but when the list of nominees came through from the War Department, Clark's name was not on it. The president queried his Secretary of War, who explained that Clark had been left off through a misunderstanding of my directions by a clerk. The Senate rejected Clark's nomination, but as Clark explained to his brother in a March 5th letter, it was done on the grounds of breaking through a principle, namely seniority. Clark said he was truly gratified nevertheless, for the senators had all told him they would confirm any other nomination, and indeed did so when Jefferson appointed him Superintendent of Indian Affairs for Louisiana Territory, with the rank of Brigadier General of Militia. It was midwinter in Washington, wet and cold. At the president's house, Jefferson's son-in-law, Thomas Mann Randolph, took ill. His fever rose and fell, leaving Jefferson alternately worried and hopeful. The doctor was bleeding the invalid, which certainly did him no good. Jefferson wrote his daughter Martha progress reports, complaining on one occasion that the quantity of blood taken from him occasions him to recover strength slowly. On March 6th, Jefferson informed Martha that Captain Lewis was constantly with Randolph, attending to his needs. Whatever Randolph had, Lewis caught. Jefferson also had a bad cold. Between them, Jefferson wrote Martha, "We are but a collection of invalids." Clark, meanwhile, had made it to Washington, where he was gathering up the land warrants for the men still in St. Louis, and the money due them, and preparing to head west to his new post. He and Lewis had agreed that Lewis would stay behind in the East to oversee the publication of their journals in Philadelphia. Clark's first task in St. Louis would be to see to Big White's safe return. To that end, Dearborn gave him a letter authorizing him to spend up to $400 for presents to the Mandans and to draw on the War Department for expenditures that were indispensably necessary in fitting out the party for the voyage. As an inducement to get an armed party of private traders to join Sergeant Nathaniel Pryor, recently promoted to ensign, who would lead the party returning Big White, Dearborn further authorized Clark to enter into contracts with any St. Louis merchants who were interested in pursuing the Missouri River fur trade, granting them a 2-year monopoly on a license to trade with the Indians and furnishing their engagés with rifles and ammunition. Clark received this authorization on March 9th. The following day, he visited Lewis in the president's house and was distressed to see his friend so indisposed by his illness. Lewis roused himself sufficiently to go over the details of the land warrants and the back pay. He handed over the warrants plus $6,896 in coin. They discussed the return of Big White and agreed that Pryor should attempt to enlist any men from the expedition still in St. Louis who were willing to go. After Clark left, Lewis took some pills, whether rushes or some others is not known. The next morning, he wrote his friend, already en route to St. Louis, that the pills had provided considerable relief, and I have no doubt of recovering my health perfectly in the course of a few days. He must have, because 3 days later he sent an open letter to the National Intelligencer condemning several unauthorized and probably some spurious publications now preparing for the press on the subject of my late tour to the Pacific Ocean by individuals entirely unknown to me, and warning the public to be on guard with respect to such publications. He said these spurious works would depreciate the worth of the work he was preparing, and asked for patience from the public, which was clamoring for the journals. As much time, labor, and expense are absolutely necessary in order to do justice to the several subjects. With the letter, he included an announcement of his own work, which would give interested people an opportunity to join the list of subscribers. He promised to have the map published by the end of October, with the first volume, The Narrative, following by January 1, 1808, the second, On the Geography of the Country, the Indians Encountered, and the Prospects for the Fur Trade, and the third, On Scientific Discoveries, coming shortly thereafter. Lewis said that only Robert Fraser had been given permission to publish his journal, and warned that Fraser, who was only a private, was entirely unacquainted with any scientific matters and could provide merely a limited detail of our daily transactions. He concluded, "With respect to all unauthorized publications relative to this voyage, I presume that they cannot have stronger pretensions to accuracy of information than that of Robert Fraser." It was a strange document, mean-spirited in tone and content, so unlike Lewis, who had previously been active in promoting the interests of Clark and the men. It was defensive, even greedy. There were no misspellings, which indicates that someone proofread it for him. It used words Lewis did not ordinarily use, such as depreciate, subjoined, and expunged. Further, Lewis was a man whose reputation for telling the truth was unassailable, but he almost certainly lied when he wrote that he had heard reports to the effect that individuals entirely unknown to him were preparing books on the expedition. What he had heard was that Sergeant Gass was about to issue a prospectus for a book based on the daily journal he had kept, as Captain Lewis had ordered him to do. In fact, the Gass prospectus did appear 6 days later in the Pittsburgh Gazette. All this leads to the conjecture that when Jefferson and Lewis heard about the Gass journal, they went into something akin to a panic. Jefferson may have urged Lewis to issue his warning against spurious publications and helped him write the letter. Whoever was responsible for the letter, it was a mistake. It made Lewis look cheap, ungrateful, pleading for special interests, himself. It opened him to ridicule. He could be considered guilty of a double cross, for he had given Fraser permission to publish and then denigrated the product, which he had not seen. And how dare he assert his right to publish for profit while denying it to Fraser and Gass? The battle in Washington over who got the insider's memoirs out first was underway, a battle Lewis was sure to lose. It would cheapen his product, which infuriated him. It would cut into his profit, which made him so angry he lost his common sense. Lewis knew how vulnerable he was on the money question. In his prospectus, he wrote that the author declares to the public that his late voyage was not undertaken with a view to pecuniary advantages, and explained that he was asking for subscribers only because he needed to know how many copies to print. If Jefferson was party to this sordid stuff, as seems likely, he too was guilty of gross misjudgment. The Gass prospectus was as bad, from Lewis's point of view, as it could have been. It promised a daily narrative, a description of the country and its flora and fauna, soil and minerals, and more. What really hurt was a paragraph explaining that around the campfire, the several journals were brought together, compared, corrected, and the blanks filled up, meaning that early subscribers would be reading material corrected and approved by the captains. What cut to the bone was the publisher's promise to have the work ready for delivery in 2 months for a price of $1 per copy. There went Lewis's market. To add to the injury, Gass's publisher sent to the newspapers his reply to Lewis's warning to the public. The publisher seized on the vulnerabilities Lewis had created to ridicule him. He wrote of what you very modestly call your late tour. He said Mackenzie had faced greater dangers with 1/4 of the men and done it first. He attacked Lewis's compensation from the government. Why, sir, these grants and rewards savor more of the splendid munificence of a prince than the economy of a republican government. He raised the question, Where was your journal during the session of Congress? Snug, eh? He exposed Lewis's double standard. Every man of sense must agree that these journals are either private property of the individuals who took them or public property. In one sentence, he managed to show he knew what he was talking about while suggesting that Gass's journal would be more readable than Lewis's. He may, in some respects, be considered as having the advantage, for while Your Excellency was stargazing and taking celestial observations, he was taking observations in the world below. Lewis's work had been insulted and preempted. He was a writer. We can assume that his mind never stopped composing his reply. But he had the good sense, finally, to keep quiet. He made no public response. One of the would-be authors, Robert Fraser, was in Washington. He was planning to join Clark in Fincastle, Virginia, for a return trip to St. Louis, where he had been called to appear in the trial of some of the Burr conspirators. Despite Lewis's comments about Fraser in the newspapers, the two men maintained a friendly relationship. Lewis loaned him $50 with the understanding that Clark would deduct that amount from Fraser's compensation and return it to Lewis. He sent via Fraser Clark's commission as Brigadier General of Militia and instructions for Frederick Bates, appointed by Jefferson to be Secretary of the Territory, a position equivalent to that of Lieutenant Governor. Clark was staying at the home of Colonel George Hancock, Julia's father. In a mid-March letter to Lewis, he reported that he had sent Fraser on to St. Louis, along with Lewis's letter to Bates and one of his own. Clark was in a fine mood. He had his commission, he was headed west, his friend was arranging for the publication of his map and journal, and he had been successful in his courtship. In reporting on the latter, he wrote with uncommon levity. "I have made and attacked most vigorously," he began. "We have come to terms, and a delivery is to be made 1st of January, when I shall be in possession highly pleasing to myself. I shall return to Virginia at that time, eagerly to be in possession of what I have never yet experienced." He hoped Governor Lewis would not object to his absence from St. Louis. "You can hint a little on that subject if you think proper and let me know." Like most young men in love, Clark wanted a similar happiness for his friend. He made an oblique reference to F, a young woman Lewis was courting. "But should the thing not take to your wish," he went on, "I have discovered a most lovely girl, beautiful, rich, possessing those accomplishments which is calculated to make a man happy, inferior to you, but to few others." The only trouble was her father was a Federalist. But that handicap could be overlooked, Clark said, and he knew because he had done it. He confessed he was surprised to discover that Colonel Hancock is also a Fed. I took him to be a good plain Republican. At all events, I will hope to introduce some substantial, sincere Republicanism into some branch of the family about January. The head of the Republican Party was also in a good mood. Jefferson was doing what he liked to do best, distributing new knowledge to his naturalist friends. On March 22nd, he sent Bernard McMahon some seeds brought back by Lewis, explaining that he would not get to Monticello in time to plant them and thought McMahon might put them in the ground in Philadelphia. Jefferson added that Lewis had some seeds set aside for McMahon and would be handing them over when he arrived in Philadelphia, and advised McMahon to say nothing of your receiving the enclosed seeds, lest it might lessen the portion he will be disposed to give you. In his letter of thanks, McMahon said, "I never saw seeds in a better state of preservation." High praise for Lewis's methods. A couple of weeks later, he reported that he already had a fine showing from the Arica tobacco, the perennial flax, four varieties of currants, and other seeds. He promised regular reports on the progress of this precious collection. 2 days later, Jefferson sent seeds to another Philadelphia naturalist, William Hamilton, with a similar covering note. In it, Jefferson summed up the results of the 3 months Lewis had spent in the president's house, 3 months of almost daily debriefings on what Lewis had done and found. It was a splendid tribute to his young protege. "On the whole," the president wrote of Lewis, The result confirms me in my first opinion that he was the fittest person in the world for such an expedition. Chapter 33. Philadelphia, April to July 1807. At the end of March, Lewis left Washington for Philadelphia, taking with him what Paul Russell Cutright has called perhaps the most important account of discovery and exploration ever written. His objective was singular: to get the journals and map published and made available to the scientific and lay public as soon as possible. He went at it with as much determination as he had attacked the Rocky Mountains. He got a room at the boarding house of Mrs. Eliza Wood, at Cherry, near 10th, and began making calls on the dozen or more men he was relying on for help. He started with John Conrad, head of a publishing and bookselling firm located at 30 Chestnut Street. As a first-time author, Lewis knew nothing about the preparation of a manuscript for the printer. There were plates to be prepared for the maps, drawings to be done, calculations from the celestial observations to be made, botanical descriptions to be completed, a prospectus to be written, published, and distributed, and more. Most important of all was the editing of the journals. Conrad's estimate of the publishing costs came to $4,500. This did not include the drawings, calculations, salary for an editor, who presumably would be going to St. Louis with Lewis, and other expenses, all of which would come from Lewis's pocket. Conrad also wrote, or at least helped Lewis write, a formal prospectus, which was signed by Lewis and published on June 3, 1807. Lewis had to pay for the marketing. He hired J.B. Varnum, Jr., son of a prominent Massachusetts politician, to do the work at a cost of $10. Varnum sent copies to the newspapers and distributed copies in Philadelphia, Washington, and elsewhere. The prospectus was well done, nicely designed to excite the greatest interest around the country among entrepreneurs looking to invest in the fur trade, potential settlers in the West, scientists, and the general public. Lewis promised that the first part, consisting of two volumes, would contain a narrative of the voyage. The second part, in a single volume, would cover the scientific research, under the heads of botany, mineralogy, and zoology. Part three would consist of Clark's map, along with the latitude and longitude of the important places, based on a series of several hundred celestial observations made by Captain Lewis during his tour. The price would be $10 for the first part, $11 for the second, and $10 for the map. That was a lot to promise. Lewis plunged into the task of making good on his word. He called on Dr. Barton at his home at 184 Mulberry Street, depending on Barton for help with a natural history volume. Barton agreed eagerly. There was so much to excite him in the collection of pressed plans. Lewis had done the pressing in the field, following directions given him by Barton in the spring of 1803, and had done the demanding, time-consuming, detailed work well. Almost all the plants were new to science, as were most of the animals. Lewis returned to Barton the copy of Antoine Dupratz's History of Louisiana that Barton had loaned him on the eve of his departure. On the flyleaf, Lewis wrote, "Dr. Benjamin Smith Barton was so obliging as to lend me this copy of Monsieur Dupratz's History of Louisiana in June 1803. It has since been conveyed by me to the Pacific Ocean through the interior of North America on my late tour thither, and is now returned to its proprietor by his friend and obedient servant, Meriwether Lewis, Philadelphia, May 9, 1807. The inscribed book is today in the Library Company, Philadelphia, a piece of Americana beyond price. The book, along with the others in Lewis's traveling library, was one of the few artifacts to go coast to coast and back with Lewis. Aside from the books and the then blank journals, almost everything else he took with him from Philadelphia in 1803, medicines, portable soup, scientific instruments, trade goods, and the rest, was either used up on the voyage or sold at auction in St. Louis when he returned. About the only other item Lewis carried from Pittsburgh to the Pacific and back was his rifle. Books, the journals, and a rifle. These were Meriwether Lewis's essentials. With them, he had conquered and described a wilderness. Frederick Pirsch was a 33-year-old German-born and trained botanist working with Dr. Barton. On April 5th, Jefferson's friend and Philadelphia seed merchant Bernard McMahon wrote to Lewis, to thank him for the seeds, and to recommend Pirsch to him as the proper person to make the scientific descriptions of the plants. McMahon said Pirsch was better acquainted with plants in general than any man I ever conversed with on the subject. He is a very intelligent and practical botanist and would be well inclined to render you any service in his power. When Lewis met Pirsch, he was as impressed as McMahon had been, especially by Pirsch's ability to draw plants and to give them proper scientific descriptions, areas in which Lewis felt himself to be deficient. Pirsch was excited by the prospect of assisting in the publication of the botanical part of the journals, as well he might have been, since there were over 100 plants described by Pirsch as either entirely new or but little known. On May 10th, Lewis paid Pirsch $30 for assisting me in preparing drawings and arranging specimens of plants for my work, and 2 weeks later he paid Pirsch an additional $40 in advance. Jefferson and Lewis were of one mind in regarding Peale's Museum in Independence Hall as the most logical repository for the zoological and ethnological specimens brought back from the West. As a result, with the exception of a few retained by Jefferson for the Great Hall at Monticello, and two or three fancied by Lewis and Clark themselves, Lewis handed the collection over to Peale, which enhanced the prestige of his museum immeasurably. In return, Peale went to work drawing the animals, which he mounted himself, for Lewis's book. He also painted Lewis's portrait. It is today in the Independence National Historical Park, Philadelphia, hanging in the distinguished company of Peale's portraits of Washington and Jefferson. And he made a wax figure of Lewis, informing Jefferson